Meeting tonight. The EPAC is the Environmental Protection Advisory Committee for the Alachua County Commission. And we had a goal of identifying actionable items that we could do to improve the sustainability of development in Alachua County. All of us have a lot of different expertise, but we're lucky in Alachua County to have some of the best experts in the state of Florida in many, many things at the university and in private industry. And so we took the opportunity to harness some of that talent and bring this panel to the public and open our EPAC meeting to the public. So that being said, my name is Mary Offord. I'm chair of the EPAC committee. And this is the second of three community conversations. The first covered water and wetlands. The second one, which is this one, we're talking about natural resources. And then our final meeting will be in about a month, and that is where we're going to bring it all together and talk about what we call the built environment, which is all the things that we make as opposed to what nature makes. So we want to kind of get right to the point, but there's a few ground rules that I want to discuss. Because this is our official EPAC meeting, I have to sort of run it as an EPAC meeting. So first, I need to have a determination of quorum. So can all the EPAC members raise their hands, please? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Okay, we have a determination of quorum. And can I get a motion to?
So move,
okay. We'll begin the meeting. I'd like to introduce the panel members and go straight into work. Oh, a couple more ground rules. We are, like I said, we're not going to be taking verbal questions from the audience, but we do encourage you to text your comments to the number there at the top of the screen. Or everybody should have pencil and paper in their chair. You can write them and bring them up here to the front, and we'll take the questions that way. Also, as you come up with concerns or ideas or something that isn't being addressed, feel free to write it on a post-it note and walk right over there and stick it on that piece of paper over there where it says natural resources. We would like to harvest all of your ideas and thoughts tonight, all of your concerns. So we'll take that back to our meetings. We've been meeting weekly, and we'll discuss those things and take your ideas into account. So. Also, if you feel the need to get up and eat pizza or get a drink, help yourself. We want this to stay quasi-informal, except for you guys. You have to stay up there. And if the pitchers of water get empty, the kitchen is through those doors and to the left. Feel free to fill it back up again and keep everybody hydrated. Okay. I would like to thank all of our panelists tonight. We have a really stellar group of folks here. First, I'd like to introduce Dr. Mark Hostetler. He's the professor of wildlife ecology and conservation at the University of Florida. He conducts research and outreach on how urban landscapes could be designed and managed from small to large scales to conserve biodiversity. He's one of the founders for UF's Program for Research Resource Efficient Communities. And he collaborates with scientists and graduate students to foster green development projects both nationally and internationally. He's the author of The Green Leap, Conserving Biodiversity and Subdivision Development. And he has produced and directed an award-winning TV series called Living Green. He writes about urban biodiversity, conservation, and green development for publications such as The Nature of Cities and The Huffington Post. So we welcome Dr. Hostetler. Secondly, Pagin Hanrahan. How many people here know Pagin? Okay, I don't need to introduce. No. Pagin is a registered professional engineer and the principal of a company called Community and Conservation Solutions. She's another native and lifelong resident of the state of Florida and Gainesville. She served Gainesville as its mayor from 2004 to 2010 and served as a city commissioner from 1996 to 2002. And before that, I happen to know she worked in EPD, because I worked with her on a couple of projects many years ago. Over the last 10 years, one of her primary clients has been the Trust for Public Lands, the Conservation Finance Program, and she's worked for land conservation and parks in multiple cities and counties in the state of Florida, and has worked on other land conservation initiatives, including Alachua County Forever and Amendment 1. She has a long list of honors and distinctions by public and private agencies, and I'm just going to list some of the titles of what they've called her. It's kind of fun. A woman who makes a difference, a woman of distinction, a voice for equality, a woman in conservation, a woman who inspires, and the female Democratic elected official of the year. So we are very lucky to have you. Bob Simons, another lifelong resident of the area, is a retired forester and ecologist who spent 45 years in the field, and he's also, literally in the field, he's also a tree farmer. Bob is one of the people that inspired me to become an environmental engineer. He was my neighbor growing up, and I tripped over bags of snakes in his garage, and he drugged me out into the woods to plant longleaf pine seedlings before it was fashionable. But he has helped restore hundreds of acres of land in north central Florida to native longleaf pine, and he typically does it without added water or fertilizer, which I find very admirable. If they make it, they make it, right? Bob serves on the board of both the Alachua Audubon and Florida Defenders of the Environment, and he's well known for his local support of environmental and sustainability initiatives. He has been frustrated in his efforts to effect positive change through the traditional methods of activism and donating to the right political parties. So he decided to embrace the notion that the pen is mightier than the sword and recently became an author. He published his first book. What did I do with it? Anyway, I bought two copies. They've already disappeared. Oh, okay. The Gold Coin of Great Falls, which is an archaeological and environmental mystery, which is set 700 years in the future after our civilization, our current civilization, has failed. And what I think makes him smile most often these days is he recently became a grandfather. So that shows real faith in the future when you procreate. His books are available for purchase in the back, so if you haven't seen it, take a look. And finally, Tom Kaye. Tom Kaye is the executive director of the Alachua Conservation Trust, which is a nonprofit that has been conserving natural, scenic, and recreational resources in north central Florida for 27 years. He holds a degree in environmental policy as well as a law degree. As a licensed Florida attorney, he has worked as a staff attorney for a large not-for-profit healthcare organization and also for the Alachua County Housing Authority. For 7 years, he worked as a litigator in civil, criminal, and real estate matters. He has volunteered on local and national political campaigns and has interned in U.S. Senator Bill Nelson's Tallahassee office during law school. As the executive director of ACT, he has worked with dozens of landowners and families to assist them in protecting their land for generations to come through acquisition, donation, and conservation easement. So, can we preemptively give our panel a round of applause? Because I know they're going to be awesome, and they're probably going to argue just a little bit. So I'm going to jump right into questions. Our first question I'd like to direct to Bob and Tom, and it's a very broad question. We're going to talk about what our current situation is. How much of Alachua County needs to be protected from development to conserve the county's biodiversity and ecosystems in general? How much of the county should be conserved?
Well, I'll start off by saying how much is presently conserved, and it's about 20% of the county's lands. That's, you know, by state, federal, nonprofit organizations. We're talking about 110,000 acres out of about 560,000 acres. I think there's, this comes to the question, is it just the number of, you know, quantity or also the quality of the land? But, you know, I think one thing that we sort of started taking as a stand in our position as an organization is this idea that E.O. Wilson, the sort of famed conservation biologist, said half Earth, right? So this idea that you're going to protect at least half of all of the Earth for conservation purposes. And I think that's a good starting point for us to just start these discussions. You know, we have about 250,000 residents, more or less, in Alachua County. You're talking in the next 25 years, adding another 45,000 to 50,000, depending on the models. You know, our economy is dependent upon a healthy environment, you know, whether it's tourism or agriculture, our springs. And so I think that's a good starting point is, as far as when we're working strategically to think about what needs to be protected. So we're about, you know, less than half the way where we need to be probably long term. And part of our position as an organization, I think, just in general, we talk to people in the conservation community, is this idea that basically, you know, if you don't conserve it, it's lost. And I think we'll get to this a little bit later, but when we talk about conservation, we're not just talking about some wildlife sanctuary. I mean, we are talking about our working land. So that includes, you know, potentially conservation easements on places like ag lands, ranch, and timberlands. Timberlands, I mean, which are really important to our economy. So that's where I would start.
I'm glad I let you go first. I agree with everything you said, so we're not going to argue over that one. One important point is I don't think the government can own 50% of the state of Florida. So this idea that some of this land that's protected should be conservation easements on working landscapes, either commercial forestry or ag lands of some sort, is essential to achieving what we need. And what we do need these open spaces for air quality, water recharge. If we pave the entire state and build it and put people in it, it's not going to work. There's not enough water, for one thing. It wouldn't be livable. So the other key, which you mentioned, is it's not just what percent, but we have to be wise in choosing which lands we're going to protect and which ones we're going to allow to be developed. And I think the county's done a pretty good job, actually, with their comprehensive plan addressing this issue. They began 20 years ago or so to come up with a comprehensive plan that a lot of work went into it, a lot of public meetings and a lot of thought, and they hired KBM to inventory the natural areas of the county and come up with what presumably were the most important lands in terms of water recharge, surface water quality, wildlife habitat, intact ecosystems, connectivity, all these kind of things. Potential recreation, which were the lands we really needed to work on most to conserve, and I think that, you know, I think it's been done right so far.
All right, you have something to say, Vicki?
I was just going to add that there's a really helpful resource on the county's Alachua County Forever page that sort of gives the metrics of that program, which you may know was passed by the voters in the year 2000, and then in 2008 there was a two-year sales tax passed Wild Spaces Public Places that was a sort of a little boost in funding for the land acquisition program that Ramesh Book runs. And I just wanted to share a couple of the statistics on that because I think it helps speak to this. In the years of those two programs together, the county preserved with its partners, which does include Alachua Conservation Trust and some of the small cities, many of the cities, almost 24,000 acres were protected by Alachua County Forever and Wild Spaces Public Places. And just to put sort of a visionary of that, that's not far off of the size of Payne's Prairie. So as you come across the prairie, you can kind of look out and see what 24,000 acres looks like. What's interesting is remaining on the A list, and Bob referenced the KBN study, that was actually also the basis for the rather scientifically oriented process that the Land Conservation Board uses to select lands for acquisition. I know that because I was hired by the county to put together the acquisition process back in 2001, and the KBN study was the basis for it. There are 27,000 acres remaining on the A list, meaning those are properties that were highly ranked by that, again, relatively scientific board. You've served on it, Bob, right?
Yeah.
That have gone through these applications and determined that these are the ones that really ought to be acquired. And so that also kind of puts it in context as sort of consistent with what's already been said, that, you know, if you look at sort of those lands that have some substantial environmental value in Alachua County, we're maybe about halfway there.
Thank you. With that in mind, and with the thought that there are some lands that are should be more strategically acquired than others, how does Alachua County differ on the east and the west side? That's been an object of discussion, and do we need to focus equally on conservation on both sides of the county, and how do they differ? What are your thoughts? So, Mark, do you want to address that? And
well, I think a lot of these issues and questions cross many different boundaries, and so I think we'll be repeating many of these pros and cons for different things when we're talking about conservation. But from a wildlife perspective, I think if you look at the state map and the ecological corridor map, the eastern side, there's a strong linkage that we're looking at that connects Ocala Forest to the forests up north, and so that's one difference on the eastern versus the western. And I think when I look at a map, the one thing, and you'll hear me talk about this over and over tonight, is it's great to identify high conservation lands and infrastructure, green infrastructure that will connect and actually protect ecosystem services and biodiversity, etc. But the one thing I think we really need, and I'll bring it up several times tonight, is how do we address the matrix that surrounds these green infrastructures? As a wildlife biologist, I see so many impacts that come from urban and rural areas that go into corridors and into conserved areas. I think that's where the next leap we really need to go is, okay, we have green infrastructure, but how do we keep the biological integrity of that green infrastructure? And I think that matrix around is really important. All the people living on the lands around there is really important.
So are you saying that, you know, when we think about conservation lands and natural resources, we should not disconnect the idea of our own backyards from the ecological systems that we're working to protect?
Yeah, I mean, you think about the recent stormwater projects, all the stuff coming from Gainesville that's going into the Paynes Prairie, and we had to re-engineer it just because of the impacts that come from the city. So we really have to think about all of that combined when we think about conserved ecosystem services and biodiversity. And you'll hear many comments from me.
That's why we ask you here, for those exact comments. Bob or Pagin, do you have anything else to add, or Tom?
Well, there are some other differences between the east and west parts of the county. The Hawthorne Formation, which is a layer of clay and phosphate and sand, it has a lot of clay in it, underlies most all of the northeast part of the county, most of the east side of the county, and thins out on a line that goes through Paynes Prairie up to Olino State Park, goes through San Francisco Hammock, and west of that line, basically west of I-75, that clay layer isn't there. So west of I-75, if a raindrop hits the surface of the soil, it doesn't slow down a whole lot before it gets to the aquifer. It goes right down through the sand. But east, the east part of them, so there's no creeks, not many lakes, there's a few, but there's really good drainage, soil drainage. The east part of the county has a clay layer underneath, and a lot of that is pine flatwoods. It also has an organic hardpan, so it's not well drained, and so there's during wet times, it's pretty wet, and there's surface drainages. There's creeks that flow both north up and toward the Santa Fe River and south towards Noonan's Lake and Orange Lake and Lochlea. So geologically, they're pretty different. The ecosystems are pretty different. The west is well-drained upland ecosystems, and the east is pine flatwoods and swamps within the pine flatwoods. Pine flatwoods is mostly pines, longleaf or slash pine, naturally, with understories of gallberry and salt palmetto and so on. But interspersed in that are a lot of wetlands, and pine flatwoods is often 20 to 30% wetlands, cypress domes and so on. So the county is pretty different ecologically, soil, geologically, the soils are different, and the suitability for different activities, whether it's development or farming or growing pine trees or whatever is also different.
And to sort of throw in one more thing based off what Bob just said there, with when you talk about the soil impacts, one of the things that's sort of occurred as a result of that, because the land's on the western side of the, I mean, there's probably a lot of different factors, but one of the factors certainly for where development's been occurring has been on the western side of the county, in part because it's well drained. And so to me, it's seemed at least easier to develop in some ways. And from a conservation standpoint, it's made it more challenging to try to conserve lands over in that area, because quite frankly, if I'm over on the eastern side of the county, I might be paying, you know, $1,500, $2,000, $2,500 an acre, and then the same, you know, same amount of acreage on the west side of town is fetching $10,000, $20,000 an acre. So when you're looking at conservation priorities, that's got to be taken into consideration when you're trying to, you know, figure out corridors and just how much land you're trying to protect. And so that's something we're dealing with every day, unfortunately, especially right now when dollars are really tight from a state level. It's had a pretty big impact on where we can focus our energies as an organization. I think you can even see that on the county level too, where they're putting their energies. Quite a bit has been on the eastern side of town, just because land is cheaper.
So you mentioned before, Tom, when we think about conservation easements, we also often think of them in terms of like state forests and wetlands and more natural environments. But as you said, there's also agricultural easements, timberlands, there's even historical and cultural significance lands that might be put into conservation easements. How do these other kinds of conservation easements contribute to the sustainability of the county? When we think about the county as a whole, how do timber easements and agricultural easements increase the sustainability of the county, or do they?
I think they do. I think one of the things it does is, you know, instead of buying a land, what we call like fee simple or an outright acquisition, with an easement, you know, you want it staying economic, you know, production, although I'd argue that conservation lands have obviously a benefit in a number of different ways. But if it's continuing to be used from a, you know, an economic standpoint, from creating jobs through, you know, whether it's timber, agriculture, one of those things, you've got that economic benefit. But then you're also, you know, easement usually pays anywhere from 20 to 50% of the value of the land, sometimes a little bit more than that, depending on how many rights you're giving up. So when you think about what you could potentially conserve, it's a greater amount of land because you're paying less for that easement, or in some cases people donate easements too, but let's just argue for, you know, purposes here that you're purchasing them there. Your dollar stretches further, so instead of maybe paying $10,000 for that acre over on the western side of the county, you're paying $5,000. It continues to provide jobs and food for the community, and it's in conservation essence. It's not going to get turned into some kind of development.
Well, I was inspired when I lived in Europe for a short time, and I was inspired there by the fact that farmlands and those types of, they even thought of them as cultural resources, not just producing farmlands, were very carefully protected. And do you see us moving in that direction in terms of protection of agricultural lands?
Tom and I are doing a mind meld up here because we work together with ACT. I'm on the board and he's the director, doing the hard work every day. I was just going to share a couple. I've worked on a couple of conservation easements from when I was with ACT and also in public office, and I'll just sort of mention the range of them.
Mm-hmm.
One that's a facility that you all may be familiar with that I actually helped write and document and go back, you're supposed to go back year after year, and ACT does a very careful job of that, was donated to Alachua Conservation Trust by the Retirement Home for Horses, which is a beautiful place to go if you've never been there. But the owners, the Gregorys, wanted to be sure that it always remained in a carefully well-maintained way as both open land and for its sort of humane purpose for the animals. So that was written, and it included details about, you know, how many animals could be kept at any one time and how many could be buried there and so on and so forth. Another, which was actually, for a time, a really problematic easement, actually was one that ACT got donated to it in Yankeetown. And it's a colorful story I won't go into all the details of, but when I inherited as ACT's director in the early 2000s, it was in dispute. And ultimately the owner kept trying to sell the land for development, and ACT kept saying, no, the easement prevents that. And it would have sold for development for a hotel or something along those lines, a condo, something along those lines, had there not been this easement on it. And then ultimately it was purchased through Florida Communities Trust, which is a Florida Forever program, and put into a park. The last I'll mention is that there is a conservation easement over the city of Gainesville's well field, about 8,000 acres. It will always remain undeveloped to protect the community drinking water supply. That was executed by the St. John's and Suwannee River Water Management Districts with the city's encouragement. The underlying land is owned by Plum Creek, but it will always remain. And it has details about, you know, what type of pesticides you can or can't apply, what types of nutrients you can or can't apply in order to ensure that our drinking water remains safe. So easements can be put together for a variety of different purposes and do a variety of different good, but they do need to be carefully, you know, inspected and maintained every year.
With that in mind, is that we talk a lot about the water use in agricultural applications in this county, and if we have an agricultural conservation easement, how is water use addressed as part of that conservation easement? Are there restrictions on water use? Are there?
It depends on the intent of the easement. I mean, some easements are actually even intended just for their historical purposes or scenic purposes, but if they're intended for conservation purposes, then the maintenance of that land requires restrictions on water use. You certainly can write that into the easement.
Is that, I mean, maybe the question should that be written into more conservation easements, particularly ones with agricultural?
Yeah, I would say most likely yes.
In terms of that as well as nutrient loading. Let's see, we'll start to move away from conservation easements and talk about some other things, but I do want to ask, are there lessons learned from land conservation of the past, and what can we expect in the future of land conservation? Are things changing? Is there a better way to do things?
You haven't talked in a while.
Go ahead, pass. I'll pass that one on.
Well, let me then say this. When I grew up in Florida, we always thought of the state park system as like the state's version of a conservation easement. I bought land next to a state park because I just assumed that land would never be developed. And I thought that was safe. But now we're seeing a threat to our state parks, and their uses are, you know, there's suggestions that the use may change. You know, what was a natural beach environment could now become possibly a golf course, which some people still think of as some sort of a conservation easement, but I don't really think so. How can we protect conservation easements through changes of ownership, and are there ways to think about how conservation easements might be approached by changing political parties or political environments?
Well, it seems to me you started out talking about conservation land in general, and now you're asking about conservation easements.
It can be conservation land in general. That's fine. I tend to use them interchangeably.
Conservation easements are written as a contract, and they can be written in any which way. You know, it depends on what the objective is and what the other party is willing to do and that sort of thing. So conservation easements are very variable and diverse. And one of the good things about them is if, in most cases, the landowner will manage the land. So the public agency, whatever it is, doesn't have to put in a lot of effort. They don't have to hire some rangers and so on to manage the land. They have to inspect it every once in a while, but the land will still pay taxes and it'll still be managed by the landowner. And, you know, depending on the objectives, you'll get some conservation benefit. Lands that are owned by the public, like state parks and state forests, national forests, and so on, need to be managed. And the ideas of management have changed over the years. I'm old enough to remember when prescribed burning wasn't very popular. And what prescribed burning was done, most of it was done in Florida. Out west, they didn't do any, you know, up north. But it was done in the wintertime. And I can remember it was in the 1980s that the Forest Service, National Forest Service in Florida, began to experiment with doing growing season burns and burning in the summertime. And it was great for restoring ecosystems, the sand hills and the flatwoods. So ideas change. Invasive species have gotten to be a much bigger issue, and a really tough issue. And the adjacent lands impacts, they involve invasive species, but they involve a lot more than that, runoff and other things, loose pets and whatever. So there's a lot of issues. And as Florida gets more crowded and water gets scarcer, some of these issues will become more difficult and more important, I think.
And I'll bounce off of what Bob said. And real quick, people were talking about conservation easements, and I don't know if everyone understands what that is. It's, as Bob said, it's a contract, but basically the land stays in private ownership. The owner gives up their certain rights, usually development rights is the most critical one, but the land stays in private ownership. And as Bob mentioned, it's then the obligation, which is of the long-term expense of management, is no longer that of like the conservation organization or water management district or county or state, other than going out to monitor every year and sort of make sure they're following the conservation easement, the sort of those reserve rights and those prohibited uses on the property. And I think one of the things you're seeing right now, you talk about the past and the future, I think what you're seeing on a state level anyways, and this is also happening on a national level, is there is a greater concern about what the management cost is going to be for these properties going forward and how do you contain that cost. And so we are seeing a movement towards conservation easements as a model over, say, going into fee simple ownership for like a state park or a national forest. And it seems like a really great idea. Now, as I think maybe the only lawyer on the board, I will also say I've got great reservations about conservation easements as you go forward with these things, because, you know, we're sort of in our first generation transitioning to the second generation of conservation easements. And so what you're seeing is you've got people, I think Bob, we've got a number of people that have got, you know, conservation easements on their property, and they were the ones that entered into those contracts, and now they have their heirs, or maybe those people inheriting their property, or however it goes forward, and they weren't the ones that agreed to this conservation easement. And so you're starting to see challenges to these conservation easements, which is every lawyer's dream. And I said, I've got 16-month-old twins, and I say, you know, if I ever get in hard on money, what I will do is I will leave this job and go into the job of either fighting them or, you know, trying to break them, and that's what's happening right now. And in fact, I won't name the law firm, but one of the firms that's done the most conservation easements in the state, drafted a lot of them, is now trying to unwind them. And so they're trying all sorts of new causes of action to dismantle these same conservation easements that were put in place to protect lands, supposedly for forever. In the state of Florida, if you didn't know, perpetuity is 360 years, I believe is what the statutes say with perpetuity is. So I put that in mind, so when we start having discussions, I'm still a very firm believer that, you know, acquisitions and fee ownership is a great way of going, because while it may have some additional costs, what's the cost of litigation and that unknown? And that can be monstrous, especially when you're trying to plan.
Can I comment? So one of the things that we have seen some of in Alachua County to protect either conservation easements or maybe more importantly lands that have been acquired using public dollars for the benefit and enjoyment of the public is you try to spread out the responsibility for protecting that land. And in the case of a conservation easement, you might have more than one holder of the easement. You might, for example, have a nonprofit and another governmental agency, like one of the water management districts, or two different nonprofits, or something along those lines. In the case of the public lands in Alachua County, both Alachua County and the city of Gainesville passed a couple of years ago. I mean, I think it was, I'm sure it was in the tenure that I was serving, but I couldn't put a year on it, but they passed protections for public lands called the Registry of Protected Public Places. And so both the City Commission and the County Commission have considered a list of properties to put on that registry, and then in order to change the boundaries or change the use as a natural area, you would actually have to have a vote of the public. So that is a sort of secondary way of ensuring that we see some protection. And I'll just, you know, since I think your question was a little bit politically oriented, I'll just mention one of the things that's been kind of fascinating in the arc of my participation in public land programs is that back in the heyday, which was actually, for the record, during Jeb Bush's administration, that was actually in the last 20 years when we had the largest allocation of dollars to land acquisition. It was really sort of, I think, embraced across all party lines by publicly elected leaders, and it was seen as something, as a sort of positive alternative to regulatory approaches, rather than saying, you know, you can't develop these wetlands, or you can't, you know, dredge this, you know, whatever, we're going to purchase those lands that we think ought to be protected. Nowadays, there is some of the fiscal concern that you've heard mentioned. There's some, you know, paranoid theories out there, quite frankly, about public lands and so on. And so, you know, it's just a slightly different environment, and we've seen that in the debate around adoption of Amendment 1. I think at the end of the day, the fact that Floridians have so strongly spoken, 75% of the ballot box, that we do believe in conserving Florida's natural resources, I think that ultimately will prevail, but it hasn't been an easy effort so far.
With there's a popular definition of sustainability that talks about people, planet, profit. So you protect the planet, you take into account social justice factors, but ultimately, for something to be sustainable, it has to be economically viable. So when you think about economic viability in conservation lands, what are some of the, are there good models for economically sustainable conservation lands out there? Or what are we doing to keep conservation lands economically viable? I know Tom works at a place that has a plan. Tom, is that something that you know more about?
Well, I mean, I think certainly when you look at conservation organizations in general, they're starting to look at, like they had never had before, you know, the economic impact of their stuff, and a lot of organizations are helping us on that front when we're talking about the benefits of it, and it goes sort of to the political arena, because the number one thing, I was up in D.C. last month talking with our elected officials, and you know, the number one thing they want to ask you is, you know, the economic impact, or what's this going to cost us? And they've got a whole score sheet now, and they're looking at different programs and projects going on. And so, I think one of the things we've gotten better at, and the Audubon Society has been very helpful at this, they've really done a good job of looking at what is the economic benefit of, you know, people coming to conservation lands and using those lands. And Sheep Flow is a great example in our community. I think the economic benefit of that project long term is going to be tremendous, just by the number of people that are going to come to the state to do that. And I'm not talking about just our local people, but people from out of state and even outside the country. So I think we're trying to do a better job of that when we're looking at all kind of conservation lands, at what the economic benefit of that is. And I want to go back to one. Is this okay to go back on one thing? You know, we talk about the future of conservation. One of the things you're going to start seeing, for better or worse, based off of some of those concerns with easements or the possibility, like we saw about a year ago, with the potential surplus lands, I think one of the models you're going to start seeing, and we're actually looking at this right now, is basically doubling up. So you might buy a piece of land in fee simple and then do a conservation easement with another organization. So then the event that someone says, hey, we're going to sell this off, you've got another backup that says, well, wait a second, you can't do that because we've got this additional protection on it. Or if you're going to buy a piece of land and flip it to the state, you might put a reverter or a rider, that's pretty complex kind of terms, legal stuff, basically that says, excuse me, if for whatever reason you're not going to use this for conservation and try to move out of this, then it goes back to the organization that helped secure it in the first place so that you don't lose it. And you know, the downside of that course is it sort of slows things down. It's more paperwork. It's a little bit more bureaucracy. But it does allow for an additional level of protection. And when you've got people in the community, you know, giving to organizations or providing tax dollars to the county to buy lands, I think you need to give those people that reassurance. So it's not exactly the question you're asking about the economic thing, but it.
No, I agree with that. But the back to, does, I'm not sure if anybody recognizes how the ACT is involved with the Green Conservation Cemetery process in terms of using that money for conservation purposes. Would you like to share that briefly for anybody that might not be familiar?
Sure. So, I mean, it's sort of a growing concept. It's a sort of a twofold thing. One, there's the, it's a green burial, so that means, you know, you're not using any kind of artificial material, so no metal, no treated wood, when you're burying somebody, no vault. So it's got a lower impact on the environment. And then the second part of the concept of Prairie Creek Conservation Cemetery is that, you know, half the cost of, you know, your burial goes towards future conservation. So it's this, as far as our economic model, this idea that, you know, your death in a sense is going towards the future acquisition of conservation lands, and it's sort of catching on. Pretty much every time I go to any kind of national conference, someone's asking us about it as a potential model. But like I say, it's sort of like the startup. You know, it's one of those things. Dean can rely on this too. You know, you put a lot of money in it right now with the hope it's gonna, you know, blossom. And I think it unfortunately it's a little morbid. But it's like you gotta wait for, like, you know, the baby generation to die before we're really gonna cash in on this bad boy. So we'll see. But it's a novel idea. It's really catching on. It's just out in Colorado, and lots and lots of people like that idea. And it's an interesting way to potentially protect other conservation lands by using it for an alternative use and have a low impact on it.
Well, we've had a question from the audience that speaks to, what is the ideal percent of the county that should be green space to counter the carbon impact today and in 10 years? And that also brings to mind my question, using carbon sequestration or anything like that as a way of maintaining conservation lands. Would anybody like to address that as a question?
I get the mic again. Sorry about that. So this is it's a pretty interesting concept. I can't tell you the percentage. One of the things that's debated right now is, you know, if you're talking about turning carbon into a market, is what's the value of that? It has been explored on a county level. I know there's been some discussion anyways internally among staffers. I've talked with people about it. We don't have a mandatory market like we do in California, but that market's actually transferable. So you could actually do projects, and we've been considering it here in Alachua County, using the carbon market, but you need a pretty big piece of conservation land, and then you also, it's a pretty complex thing, but basically you got to keep those trees in place that are there to get it to count. So you couldn't just go in there, clear cut it, and then plant like longleaf if you were doing restoration. Sorry about it. So there's an idea, but one of the things that would be an interesting concept for Alachua County, and I kind of like this, in Houston, they've got Galveston Bay Foundation, another great land trust. They've got an interesting project where they're working with the oil and natural gas industry to do a voluntary carbon market. And they're actually planting seagrass as the way, it's like a blue seagrass as a carbon catch. And so it's a voluntary thing. And so then they're sort of setting the market value for that and using that to both sort of offset the impact that the oil industry is having, but at the same point in time, you know, conserving additional lands and protecting they're like the marine wildlife and what have you. And so maybe someone else wants to jump off of that.
It's interesting that we come down to percentages when we talk what percent of the county or what percent of the land use we conserve for biodiversity and for ecosystem services. I think it's really more about what's the quality of the land, what's the where can we strategize, where we can best design as development grows out from the center out into Alachua County, what types of lands really sequester carbon in a very high and economical way. So I think identifying that is probably more important than the percentage, is really trying to figure out where the best locations, wetlands, you know, medium to large trees. We've done some research looking at even designs of subdivisions, how you can maximize carbon sequestration and storage. It's two different things. But But that flip side of the coin is how much we are emitting as a city. And so that side, when I look at green space, there's all types of green space. You can think of mowed parks as green space, or you know, wooded wetland or wooded lands that have vertical height structure from the ground to the canopy. Those are very different things. And so one of the strategies I would think about when you think about green space is what type of green space do we want? And how can we minimize the inputs into that green space? Because if you factor in irrigation, fertilizer, pesticide use, mowing, all that emits so much CO2, and nitrogen, and you think about nitrous oxide, I mean, that's a greenhouse gas that's like 300 times worse than carbon dioxide. So all those variables, when we think about the carbon footprint, we got to think not only about what we conserve, but how much we're emitting, and those two will help balance the county as we go forward.
So that might be the thought of, you know, how much carbon sequestration would you have to consider when you put a subdivision another 5 miles away from the city center?
Yeah, and how that subdivision is designed and managed. I mean, you can imagine, I think at the last meeting, you have no irrigation. Irrigation is a huge energy consumption, and so that's all the fertilizer that goes onto the land. And I mean, if you knock that out of the subdivision, you decrease that carbon footprint.
Yeah, by a considerable amount. And what do you think, and to go down a completely different thought process, what will the effect of sea level rise be on our conservation lands and on our natural resources in general in Alachua County? And is that something that we should be thinking about and taking into account when we think about conservation lands now?
Instead of collecting shark teeth in Coffin Park, we'll be seeing shark. Sure.
I'll take a stab at it just for fun. I mean, I think one of the question marks with respect to the, you know, changing coastline associated with sea level rise and the potential also for more damaging storms is sort of the presumption that if people want to stay in Florida, they might be looking to come inland off of the, you know, direct coast. That's all very speculative as to, you know, what reactions those coastal communities are going to have, what kind of protections they might put up, what the market might be here or elsewhere. But, you know, one thing that I do think is that, you know, this is going to continue to be a desirable place to live for many different reasons. I mean, obviously, we're a great community, a great cultural center, a great educational center, and I can only assume that we're going to continue to attract growth. And so, you know, sort of working off what Mark and Bob and Tom have said, I think it is kind of incumbent on our community to do what we can to preserve what we think is most special about the community and to build up those areas that we think need work. And that's, you know, that's sort of the challenge, is being both for protecting those areas that we want to protect and also improving the parts of the community that have really been left behind. And unfortunately, and this kind of goes to the earlier question about East Side versus West Side, you know, having served in office for 12 years and worked for the county for 6 before that, you know, there is a very, and it's, you know, it's ecological, it's geological, it's political, it's associated with the interstate, but there's also a racial and economic component to it that, you know, the two sides of the county are not created equal in lots of different ways.
Would Bob or Tom, would you like to take a stab at that?
Well, the global warming and sea level rise and all that is a real interesting topic to me. I think it's a little stretch to think that Alachua County is at the epicenter of it, but I went to a conference in about 1983 that Florida Power and Light put on, and they invited the global warming, sort of the climatologist experts from around the country. A guy came from Denver, and a couple people, a guy named Hansen from Washington, D.C., and they invited a number of environmental leaders. They invited Marjorie Carr, and she invited me to come along with her. It's sort of an advisor. We had a three-day conference in 1983. Those guys had no doubt in 1983 that global warming was real, what was causing it, and so on. Scientifically, there was no doubt. And there was no doubt that the ocean was going to rise. And the ocean's probably going to rise for the next 1,000 or 2,000 years. It's not how high is it going to be in 50 years or 100 years. It's just going to keep going because we've put enough carbon dioxide in the atmosphere to guarantee that. Even if we stopped emitting today, the ocean's going to rise for 1,000 years. And 1,000 years from now, most of Greenland will have melted. It's going to take 1,000 years maybe, but it'll melt. That'll raise sea level 20 or 30 feet. It's going to come up. And every bit that it comes up limits the amount of fresh water we have. Underneath our lens of fresh water in Florida, we have salt water. And when the ocean comes up, the salt water underneath comes up. So we're adding more people and we're taking water back away. One of the things that all of this tells me is we need to pay more attention to water.
Okay. We are at the halfway point in our program. We would like to break for about 10 minutes to give the speakers a chance to refill water glasses. This is also an opportunity for you guys, if you would like to approach anyone up here and make a suggestion, ask a question, or say thank you. That's all a good, this is a good time to do that. So if we could get started in, it's 6:59 right now, so if everybody could be back in their seats at 7:10, that would be super helpful. Everybody stretch your legs.